One of the things that excites me about today is that I get to introduce all of you to people who I think are really cool. And obviously all of us are really cool in our own way, and any one of us could be up on that panel and have things to contribute to this conversation, but I chose these four folks because I think they have interesting and diverse angles at ministry in our culture and in our context in our time. And I wanted to, for us to, for a few things, I wanted to give us an opportunity to sort of wrestle with some of Brian's ideas in our particular context, in our ministries, in our practical daily lives. But also, I wanted to introduce each other so that these are all local folks. You have their bios, in the handout. So if somebody says something that you find is super interesting, you want to learn more about, well, you can look them up and you can reach out to them and you can start a conversation. I'm sure they would all be glad to make a new friend today. So that's one of the hopes of what we're about to do. Now, as the moderator, I get to ask the first two questions. So after my first two questions, we will open it back up and we'll use the same format as we did for Brian. So, hello everyone. First question, just for the four, is just start off, take a minute and tell us your name and what work you do. And we'll start with Eric and move on.
So my name is Eric Ogie. I am a ministry intern at The Crossing in my third year there. I graduated from UW-Madison in religious studies a few years ago, and I'm applying or waiting to hear back yet from all the divinity schools I applied to, so I'll be starting seminary in the fall and pursuing ordination in the United Church of Christ.
My name is Winton Boyd, and I am a pastor at Orchard Ridge United Church of Christ here in Madison. I've been here 15 years, and I also do a lot of retreat facilitation with the Center for Courage and Renewal, which is sort of rooted in the work of Parker Palmer.
Hi, my name is Christina Roberts, and I am a co-pastor with my husband, Chris, who will be on this afternoon's panel. And I also work with an organization called Blue Ocean Faith, and we're very much in the conversation that Brian was talking about this morning, and we're exploring ideas of how to take this conversation into more places.
My name is Wendy Cooper, and I'm currently the organizer for a group called Dane County United, which is a local affiliate of the Industrial Areas Foundation here in Dane County. In 2012, I completed seminary at Chicago Theological Seminary, and I am pursuing ordination in the United Church of Christ.
Great. So this question, again, is for the four of you, and whoever is ready first can start. What I'd like to hear is for each of you to take a few minutes to respond to what we just heard Brian talk about. How did it resonate with your experience in ministry, or not resonate with your experience in ministry? And what specific issue that you're going through or that you've gone through did it speak to, and how did it speak to it? Okay, so general, how do you resonate? And then more specifically, can you think of a specific issue that what Brian talked about either that speaks to, and how does it speak to it? Is that clear? Yeah? Great. But Wendy, you'll start.
I just appreciate this message so much. I don't spend my daily life in the church working with a specific group of people, although I play a role in my own church. What I do every day is have conversations, sometimes 25 or 30, what we call relational conversations in the community, and I'm always trying to find out, what is weighing heavily in people's lives. And I think this presentation speaks very much to what I hear from all different kinds of people every day, every week. Because everything's changing, right? Everything's falling apart. Everything's being questioned. And I have been rereading a social scientist from Europe, Zygmunt Bauman, who I will admit I first took his book off the shelf because I just loved his name, Zygmunt Bauman. Right? But he wrote a book called Liquid Times. And what struck me in that book, and the reason I'm returning to it, is what I hear from people all the time is they lack a sense of groundedness. They don't feel like they can predict what's going to happen in their lives or in their children's lives. They can't. They lack solidity. So one of my questions about the church is my own. I believe the church is always called to be countercultural. And if everything is changing and we're losing everything, what is the role of the church in offering solidity, something solid, a grounding for people? Which does not necessarily mean doing that in the way that it's been offered in the past. But what does it mean for the future to offer solidity? And I, what I hear from Brian, what I hear from people I'm in conversation with, is the core is the need for really authentic relationships. That's perhaps where the solid ground is and what's lacking. Families are spread out. You know, even our relationships don't stay the same. So how does the community of the church, not the building of the church, not the doctrines of the church, but the community of the church, offer future groundedness and solidity in a time of just extraordinary change?
Next.
There are many things that Wendy said that I resonate with, and I very much resonated with Brian's talk. I was remembering, as you were speaking and talking about the post office, being in a session in the early 1980s where the same theme was used with the railroads. And so I was thinking, as you talk, now 30 years is not a lot of time, but this is a conversation in certain segments of the church around change that has been going on. And so one of the things, then I started thinking about my own tradition, which comes out of the congregational tradition that broke away from Europe for a lot of reasons, but one of them was kind of a relational-based approach to doctrine, to organizing. And I say in our new member classes that it was a covenantal arrangement. In practice, it often ended up meaning if you didn't agree to the covenant, they kicked you into Rhode Island, right, instead of Massachusetts. So they didn't always live out the aspirations they had. But at the root of everything was not a system of belief, but a commitment to other people. And the reason I stay in the local church is because I feel like in that balance of spirit, of individual spirituality and community spirituality in the face of cultural and institutional change, the greatest skill is adaptability and flexibility and nimbleness. And the size of a local congregation our worshiping attendance is 150 to 200. That's a size that can be nimble. You get too much bigger and then you start becoming a small institution. That size, you have some sense of momentum. And the other piece that I was thinking about as a young adult when I became a pastor and I started hanging around other folks who were clergy, many of them who were older, I saw all this grief about what was and what is no longer. And I always felt out of sync with that because I didn't have that experience of Christendom and the church being the center of the community. It just wasn't part of my experience. And so it's always taught me that our lens and our set of expectations really makes a difference in how we identify where we are. Very quickly, yesterday I was in a conversation where somebody whose church, she said, is needing to die. I mean, it's numerically low. And all around the friendship hall or the fellowship hall are all these pictures of old confirmation classes when there were 30, 40 kids, and now there's like 15 in worship. And we just raised the question, what would it look like if you weren't surrounded by all those pictures, right? Because they just remind you what you aren't. If you took this to another location and you had 15 or 20 really faithful, excited people, it's a very different feel. So all that around expectations, I think, is critical. And having felt out of sync for so long, for me, is a gift because I now recognize that's just what it means to be in the churches. And that might be countercultural, too.
One of the thoughts that kept coming back to mind throughout was the ability to have a radical freedom of imagination in our theological expression. And a book that I really cherish was The Prophetic Imagination by Walter Brueggemann. And this idea that throughout the Bible, throughout our faith tradition, it was this ability to imagine something alternative to what is, and not just to cling to what has been, and even to take what has been and reimagine it in our own context and give new meaning to where we are instead of just trying to teach and memorize what things were. And one leads to inspiration, I think, and replicates itself, and the other just, I think, is more static. And one of the things that we try to do at The Crossing, the campus ministry at UW that I work at, is create spaces for that freedom and to apply new images and also images from our tradition in new ways as we think about theology in our context. And you mentioned we can't do theology in the 21st century without thinking about the environment and ecology. We also can't do it without addressing racial issues, without addressing poverty, with the race to equity report that came out recently in Madison. There's all these issues that we're all aware of, and if faith isn't going to be applied to these issues for us, then it's not really relevant in any way. And I think it goes deeper than just making it social justice. The church isn't just a social justice institution. It's the church, and that's different. But it's providing this deep grounding, as you were saying, for students to engage this work and make it relevant and applicable, and even to inspire them to go deeper and further than they might otherwise be committed to doing it otherwise. I think a lot of students in my encounters have viewed religion as status quo, as sort of stagnant and static, as rather than something that's living and dynamic and breathing and changing, as you were saying. And so I think this freedom of imagination that we need to rethink the whole system, that we really need to be searching for new images and metaphors, as well as bringing the ones that have been a part of our tradition all along into our context and applying it to different issues, in order to see for students, young people, to really see that faith is relevant and life-giving today. So that was one of the big things that stuck out.
One thing I appreciated was the historical piece that you brought in, and I was just thinking back to a couple of years ago, I was invited to a retreat for female senior leaders and pastors, and there was a couple of people in their 30-somethings, and most of the women were in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And as the retreat was rolling out, this grief that you're talking about, I mean, we were just hearing all these stories of women and how they faced just these obstacles of being the only female in leadership meetings and men walking out of the room and just all of these battle wounds they experienced as women. And so there was just this amazing time of the Spirit of God just bringing affirmation and healing and encouragement. And yet us younger people in the room, it was like, wow, this isn't our story. This is amazing that you women have gone before us and paved the way for us. And so I'd be interested even to hear more of how do we hear those stories? And even though that's not our story, how do we, wow, like we appreciate that. And then how can you pass the baton on to us and we can bring health to those even younger than us? So I really appreciated that.
Great. First question for anyone on the panel, for the whole panel, however you want to address your question, you can.
Hey guys, thank you for your thoughts. I appreciate that. My name's Zeb. I come from Milwaukee. In my experience, I've been able to do international missions to places that you've been, Uganda, Malaysia, different places around the world. And it's really encouraging to see my generation of people kind of stepping into their roles as, you know, outreach, if you want to say. My question is, now I would be interested in to hear the whole entire panel's perspective on what it would take to mobilize the next generation. I see a lot of people in my generation who want to do something. They're taking steps to be a part of, you know, social justice issues. But somebody like my parents, who they're not going to be going to, to become a minister or something like that. How do you mobilize them and inspire them to reach out to their local communities and across the world? Thank you.
And then open it up, because I think we've got an excellent group of people to respond to that. When you say that, I think, Christina, about your story, if this is something for all the older people in the room, if everybody's sitting around talking about their grief and a young person comes along who wants to make a difference in the world, that could be a big downer. It was like, oh, you know. So some of us who are, you know, deep in our own grief might need to sort of deal with that and then let be. And then we're going to start realizing there are people around us who really want to get things going. And I think about you going to getting ready to go to divinity school, you know. And then I think about Wendy working with Industrial Areas Foundation, which some of you may know is one of the main organizations that tries to mobilize churches for social justice causes locally, you know, to get people to care about across the tracks, not just across the ocean. And this to me is a really interesting moment. I'm not a huge, you know, expert in like generational theory. I mean, I've read a good bit about it, but I know that my own kids who are in their late 20s and 30s, they want institutions to work. They don't want to have to throw out the institutions. They want them to work. And one of the great opportunities now, everybody's against organized religion. But I often, when people say that to me, just yesterday when I was flying here, the lady next to me on the plane, when I told her what I was, she said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to go talk to some nice people in Madison about, you know, this." She says, "Oh, I hate organized religion, you know." And you want to say, well, do you hate being organized? Like, is disorganized religion really cool? And I didn't get a chance to say this with her, but what I often get to talk to people about is to say, your frustration is not that religion's organized, that it's organized for really unworthy purposes. You wish it were organized for better purposes. And this to me is where the opportunity is there to organize and help people, give them some tracks to go make a difference in the world. But
I have three children in their 20s. And I just want to tell you a little story that for me is a lens through which to see the world. A few years ago for Christmas, I asked them if they would make a CD for me of music that they liked that they think I might like also. And I was aware when I asked for that there was a lot of music that they like that they knew I wouldn't like or they wouldn't want me to know that they liked. But what happened was I have three children and I had three different, very different CDs of music. And one was all really new music and one was what my daughter, what we call whiny women music. And my other son had this whole mix of Michael Jackson, really old stuff, really new stuff. But it was an effort in our family to say, we're moving forward together. I can't choose your music anymore. I can't tell you what things you can buy. I need to hear from you what's important. And together we'll figure out how we share things in common. If we have a long road trip and we need to listen to something together, what can we listen to that we would all enjoy? So it just strikes me that ongoing conversation about what matters. And I think often of the text from the New Testament about we have this treasure in earthen vessels. How do we focus on the treasure? And so whether it's in a building or whether it's out on a work site with, you know, with some work trip or mission trip, or whether it's in a musical setting, how do we think together about what the treasure is we're all seeking, and how do those of us who have been molding and shaping the vessels let go a bit of those vessels and see if there are new ones that might emerge that we might actually like better. Another friend who's in his 70s says, I need people who can see the horizon I can't see. My vision is limited, so I need partners who can see beyond the horizon I can see. And I think those are helpful ways of thinking. And then something will emerge that none of us will know what it is, and it'll be life-giving.
My first thought was that I think the reason I'm here and at the point of going, I think, to divinity school next year is because people in my church and even at the Crossing have sort of called me out and empowered me into different positions of leadership that Oftentimes, I think we want young people in our churches, but I think, like you said, more so as fuel, because it looks good on paper and they're just absent, and we realize that we're not going to be around much longer if they're not there. But I actually had people, my pastor, growing up and at the Crossing, that asked me to step up into leadership positions, that got out of the way and said, I believe that you can do this. You'll stumble and you'll make mistakes, but we'll be here with you, guiding you along the way. And we need churches that don't just expect us to just show up on Sundays and to go through motions anymore. We need churches that ask not just young people, but particularly young people, to step into leadership positions, knowing that they won't do it as if they've been trained to do this for 30 years and have been doing it for 30 years. But that's part of the process, and that's important. And we will have better leaders if we allow them to make those mistakes. So I think that's been the biggest thing for me has been people calling me out and asking me to do leadership positions that, frankly, even at the time, I was probably, I don't know if I'm qualified, or I don't know why you would ask me to do it, but believing in them.
I guess for me, my kids are 3 and 6, and so I maybe have a little bit different lens. But, you know, I think even at that age, you know, we talk about mobilizing, and in them, I want them to know, like, Jesus is your friend, and you can, you know, share that love with other people. And so in the mornings before school, they have their little journals with their dad, and they draw pictures of what they're going to be doing that day and inviting Jesus into music class or art class or whatever they're going to be doing. And I think it's really opened up their eyes to how can we be good neighbors to people around us. And so we were doing a remodeling project, and they had to go to the hardware store Menards, like, and, you know, multiple times, you know, in that month, and it's not fun for two little girls to go to Menards. And so we thought, well, you know what, like, why don't we pick one cashier where we'll just go to the same cashier every time? And so we began praying for this girl, Molly, the cashier at Menards. And so the girls just started looking forward to how can we be a light to Menards, because it's kind of boring sitting there all day running a cash register. And just through their love, like, they drew her a picture, and then we ended up befriending her. She kind of shared her story. She's in Madison all alone, so she's been to our home now twice for dinner, and it's because of our girls and their connection, so they're getting excited about how to be good neighbors. And I think that, you know, if we can start young and getting them excited about doing the stuff that everybody, that our adults get to do as well.
Wow. So a couple of words come to mind. One, I think we need to stay away from the word mobilizing, because, you know, someone who's done a lot of mobilization, it usually means, I think I know where we're supposed to be going, and I want you to follow me. And instead, I think we need to talk about invitation and thresholds, and what it means to do hospitality. So there's a Lutheran pastor who wrote a book called Breathing Space, and she was, I'm having a middle-aged moment. I'm going to blank on her name, but it will come to me. Heidi Newmark. She talked about, you know, the thresholds of our buildings sometimes divide us. Am I one of those people that crosses that threshold and goes into the goes to church? You know, it's an identity thing. So how do we rethink what our thresholds are? And do we wait for young people to come cross our threshold and come into our space and our rules and our ways of doing things and ways of thinking? Or do we cross the threshold and go out and have conversations and invite people through how we engage them and how important we think they are, and the invitation to join us and change us? You know, are we willing to be changed in inviting people in, or are we still, you know, the fuel thing is really like, keep us going, let us change you, let us transform you into an identity, that person that goes to church that crosses the threshold. I think we need to get rid of that. And 2 years ago, during Lent, I was a student pastor at Madison Christian Community, and there was a message in one of the Wednesday evening services about how Jesus didn't, you know, invite people to come to him so he could show them hospitality. He went out, and he showed hospitality in going out. So instead of mobilizing others, we need to mobilize ourselves to change how we think about thresholds and identity and invitation.
I told you we had cool people here today. trying to do the boy-girl thing. Is there? Great. And then we'll go, come back.
I am a pastor in northern Wisconsin, and in my community I hear an awful lot, because it's, I think, 55% Catholic. I hear an awful lot about, I don't need the organized church anymore. I'm disgusted with what I've seen. I can be spiritual alone. And so what I've heard this morning really resonates with me. And your point about thresholds in the church, I think it's really important when we view ourselves as the church that we first of all know that the reason we can't do church alone is because then we become the self-definers of truth and God, and we become God. So that's really a heretical path. Jesus showed us that our life is with others, that we care for others. They are our life. They are our mission field. They also are the place where we find virtue, and we define what is good as opposed to what is bad. And so I really appreciate all that you have said today, but how do we continue to break down those thresholds and those barriers in our own individual choices of church family or church home, and include and invite and expand without destroying 2,000 years worth Christian growth? The longer I am in this profession, the more firmly I believe that we are all going back to the origins of our faith. And that is the future church, that it will not have buildings, it will not have organizations, it will be people caring for each other.
If we want to get people re-engaging with community, the first thing we should not do is criticize them for being individualistic. Because in the act of doing that, we present the community as a critical community that's got another thing to criticize them for. Does everybody see how that could easily happen? So people are individualistic. There is a long history to them being individualistic. It has many dimensions to it. So this is where I really like what Wendy said. We actually have to come up with some good things, as you just said, to invite them to. And we have to demonstrate. I love Christina's example. It's as simple as inviting somebody over for dinner and noticing somebody's name, you know, taking that neighborliness seriously. So this sense that community is going to have to, we're almost in a rebuilding mode of rebuilding from the ground up in some ways. So there's a lot more could be said about that, but I really like the attitude that you raise that with. There's great value in community. And there are costs, too, but we have to attract people to the value first.
I can start. When I was in seminary, in one of my classes, we were visited by a Methodist minister who referred to herself as Christian-ish. And of course, we were like, well, what does that mean, Christian-ish? And what she was really expressing to us was the challenge of putting on the mantle of being Christian, right? We put it on, and we put on all that history and the oppression, the institutional oppression and injustice isn't just in our past. It happens every day. So, you know, to be willing, I think, to engage people who are rejecting the corruption, I think we have to be honest and acknowledge the corruption, acknowledge the weakness. The church is also an earthen vessel because we build it, so it's going to be imperfect. And I think people don't want to be isolated as individuals. Nobody could convince me of that. I think people were being encouraged out of community, you know, honestly, because for people who are grasping at political power, we're a lot easier to herd when we're not really in authentic and strong relationship with each other. So, you know, when I go to the gym, when, on the rare occasion that I go to the gym, one of the things that strikes me is we're, you know, all on these machines staring at televisions. I'm like, this is so bizarre that we're living in this culture that's encouraging us to be separate from each other. But I don't think that's what we want. But I do think when we're talking about invitation to join religious community, we have to be willing to acknowledge the history and the current imperfections and pain and injustice that happens within the institution.
My one thought just went back to sort of paradox. I love paradox, and especially I love that you use the imagery of death and resurrection in your presentation. And I think that while many people here and elsewhere are grieving this dying of the church, as someone who's coming into ministry, I'm sort of excited because we're at this point where we have to change, we have to rethink, we have to try new things. And that's the exciting part. We can't not do that, otherwise we will really just sit there. And so this idea of resurrection and what new communities could look like, and part of what the church has to respond to is that it's not the institution anymore that is at the center of everyone's life, and you do everything through the church. You can donate to charities, you can volunteer, you can do all of these different things outside of the church. And so the church has to rethink, how does it engage, how does it create communities that engage with other communities, that partner with these other community organizations, realizing that that shift is central to whether or not it's going to continue to be relevant again to people's lives. And so it is still there, and the church is going to have to continue to do those things, but it has to think of new ways to partner and be involved in the community in a way that it wasn't before. And so I think that gets at some of the, you know, people are volunteering and that becomes their community, or people go to the coffee shop and they see the same people there at the same time every, and that's their community. So the church needs to find new ways to partner with different organizations, I think, and become part of those communities as well.
I'd love to build on what Eric says. When you were asking the question, I was thinking, my first thought was we start where we are. So you mentioned northern Wisconsin. It's a very different setting than southern Florida or than Madison. So where are we and who are we? And when people say they don't like the church, they don't like organized religion, they want to be spiritual, whatever we all say, you know, how do we find ways to authentically engage? What does that mean? Because I don't always know when somebody says, I don't like church or organized religion. I don't really know. I don't know the story of what that is. It could mean a million things. And truth is, I probably agree with 99% of what people say when they criticize Christianity. So the first thing is to start where we are. And the other piece that, and I'm glad Eric's sitting next to me, because in our local church, one of the ways that I think we learn is by partnering with others who are ahead of us. And in my experience, the Crossing Campus Ministry here in Madison is one of those places that, for all kinds of reasons, including the people, as well as the lack of institutional history, they're able, and the fact that students, you know, have this sort of life cycle within the university that is much shorter than most cycles in adult life in congregations. You know, lots of reinvention all the time, and for us to be both paying attention and partnering with the Crossing is really valuable. In our UCC tradition, we have camps, and one of the camps has been partnering with an organization who works with kids with autism for 10 years. And it's creating community. It's creating a new way of being church. The partner organization is not religious. It has folks coming to a church camp who would not step in the door of a church. There is no religion talked about explicitly in the week they're there. And I look at that and I say, there is a form of church that I want to pay attention to. And maybe that's not even the right word. Maybe that's my old word. But relationship, authenticity, community, meeting people and finding common ground where we are, where can I look to see that happening, and where can I join that, rather than thinking, I or we as the church, thinking that we have to create it all, because people are finding this everywhere, and we have a lot to learn and a lot to gain from partnering together.
Just to add to that, I liked, you know, just the idea of when someone says, I don't like disorganized religion, what does that mean? And again, it's not a one-size-fits-all story. And so, you know, you even saying, like, yes, I do have hope for the church. Why do you ask that question? And I think everybody that's saying that, there's a different reason why. And so if we can hear their story and, yeah, I've been there too, or, you know, I've experienced some of the same things you have, or, wow, tell me more, and kind of taking that position of a learner, I think just opens up incredible opportunities and doors to be that conversation, get that going.
My question has to do with Wendy's prior comment and some things that Brian said this morning. Sarah Miles has a new book out called The City of God that I haven't finished yet, but I think I know where she's going with it. It's a story of her church in the Mission District in San Francisco taking their Ash Wednesday service out onto the street and offering the ashes to anybody who will come on the street. And they do something similar with their communion table, with the Eucharist. It's a pretty much a wide-open table if you're hungry. I mean, the question isn't, what do you believe? The question is, are you hungry? And if you are, you come to that table and you eat. So I'm wondering what the panel thinks about that sort of repurposing of those liturgical aspects of the church. And, Brian, what you are seeing, because you travel around a lot, I expect, Are you seeing those aspects of Christian liturgy being re-expressed as a really radical invitation and openness? And how is that working out?
I'll say something about that and give you guys a chance to say something more interesting. Sarah Miles is a good friend of mine, and for those of you who aren't familiar, it's really a great, worthwhile book to read, City of God, partly because Sarah and the Episcopal congregation she's part of understand themselves as being there as a resource to the community. And I used the word fuel before. There's one way to say the church is what's important and we're looking for fuel to keep it going. So come, see, versus saying we're some fuel and we've got a little fire going. We've got resources going and we want to bring blessing to the community. Do you see those two different ways of thinking? And that way of thinking, I think, is one of the things that's being reborn in us that's very exciting. But your question points out a big problem that we have, and or not an opportunity for creative thinking. How do we want to be publicly present? A quick anecdote. I was sitting up late at night with my brother-in-law a couple of years ago, and we were doing this sort of guy bonding thing where we were channel surfing, you know? And so, like, and we were sort of in deep sync because we weren't interested in watching anything. We just sort of liked going through the channels at a certain pace. And so he's going through and he gets to a televangelist and he stops. And I'm thinking, go on, go on, go on, go on. And he's not a churchgoer or anything. And he turns to me, and I was a pastor at the time, and he says, why do you let them do this? And which then got us into this interesting discussion. And he says, you know, if there was a church like yours near where I live, I'd go to it. But there's not. He says, hold it. There might be. And I would have no way of knowing it. See? So this sense, how do you ever let it be known out in the community? And I'm thinking, well, one way is you meet someone like Christina who finds out your name when you're the cashier at the, you know. But how do we want to be publicly known? And one of our big problems is that we had decades of mainline Protestants being known as the civil religion of America. And then they sort of withdrew into their nice buildings. And then evangelicals became known as the culture warriors of America. And we've had several decades of that, and for a whole lot of us, that's not working. That's counterproductive. So then how do we want to be publicly known? And I think if we just let that sort of sit and say, and we're to be in that letting be stage and be open to what could come, I think a whole lot of creative ideas would come. I'll give one example. The environment is under threat at all levels, right? It's under threat globally through things like global climate change. But also environments are protected on local levels. What would happen if a church said, gosh, we believe in the Creator and this little watershed where we live, this is our responsibility. We have to be stewards of this. We have to be caretakers. We have to mobilize the community to understand the threats to this local environment and this local watershed. And so we're going to be out there and maybe not everybody in the church, but maybe 20 people in the church will take this on and say, we're out there. And wherever they go, as an expression of their faith, they're mobilizing people to care about this little environmental corner of the world. You would get known in the community for that. Oh, St. Matthew's Church. Oh, First Baptist. They're the people who are constantly getting us to care about this part of our community. Oh, they're the people that the little church I'm part of now, you know, I was a pastor for 24 years. Now I'm a member of a wonderful little church. My church is known. Oh, that's the church that really cares about kids with disabilities. They're the place that really does great summer camp for kids with disabilities. You think that's how you want to be known in the community. Anyhow, your question just raises that, I think, for us all. And it's a wonderful question to sit with, I think.
So our church has a community garden, and I think this question of how we want to be known, I find very paradoxical. And we probably had the garden for 6 or 7 years, and I have said to the organizers of the garden, "Now this is really a tool for our work in the community." And I never felt like I was getting much traction. They wanted the garden, right? They were, and actually I noticed there could be all kinds of things going on in the parking lot, and they would never see those folks in the garden right next to the parking lot because their heads were right in the dirt. I mean, they were gardening, right? And then one day, when one of them was there by herself early evening, on a summer evening, a guy wanders into the garden, and they start talking, and she finds out this guy lives about 4 blocks away in an area of our neighborhood that is very low-income housing. He has no place to go for solitude. And he told her, I've been coming to this garden. Nobody knew him. Nobody knew he was there. And they had this whole conversation about where he was from and, you know, learned a little bit about each other's story. She gave him some tomatoes and zucchini that were ripe. And suddenly she had a vision for how this was a public space that my theorizing never would have accomplished. And so for me, the paradox is both how we want to brand ourselves and how we want to put ourselves out there. And we all, I think, in this room recognize that the branding of Christianity has been overtaken by folks who really share very little of our values. So that's important. But on the other hand, how does it emerge? Because we're doing what we feel called to do, what we love to do, and things emerge from that that are quite natural and maybe small scale to begin with, but quite honestly have a lot more life than a group of gardeners thinking about how to brand the garden. And so I just live with that paradox and that tension, and I think I'm not sure that I want a national brand, right? I think, a neighborhood brand might be the place to be. Where we can really have an impact and relationships that really matter.
About a month and a half ago, I attended a worship service at Christ the Solid Rock Baptist Church on the east side. Their pastor, Reverend Everett Mitchell and I are co-teaching a class, and he had invited me to come. And the thing that struck me in that worship service was that people's lives were being saved that day in that church and in, through that ministry. And it agitated me. It agitated me so much because I had to ask myself, do I have the audacity in my faith and my Christian identity to believe we can save lives? That we have something when we go out in the world that could potentially save lives. And I wasn't sure about the answer. I think sometimes we get stuck in church as a refuge from the world. We come to church on Sunday or maybe to Bible study or to, you know, even to committees as a refuge from the rest of the world. And it takes a certain audacity of faith to say, we need to go out because we have something life-saving to offer and the world needs us. And that's, I think, about really digging deeply into both individually and collectively in our churches about what do we believe about ourselves as Christians and what we have to bring. And so before we go out and do these things, I think we really need to ask ourselves that and think about, do we have it ourselves to go out and take it? And, you know, evangelizing, that word, that idea, you know, which makes a lot of people in my church feel a little itchy and uncomfortable. I think it's worth asking the question, why? Why are we uncomfortable with that? And what does evangelizing mean? And, you know, do we have audacity?
Maybe I kind of go along that. So I think, you know, we're just kind of simple, wanting to be good neighbors is kind of what we talk about a lot in our church and thinking through that. And so one way that we do that is we try to identify people in our lives that maybe aren't experiencing much from faith or God, and we just pray for them. And not as a tactic to get them to come to our church, but just because we genuinely want them to experience good things in their lives. And so last year my neighbor was over, and she, very disillusioned from church. I think her dad's Hindu, her mom was Catholic, and neither religion worked for her, so unchurched doesn't like it. And so I've been praying for her, and I said, hey, you know what? I pray for you regularly, and so I thought I'd ask you, since I'm praying anyway, is there anything that you want me to pray for? Because I'm already praying, and if there's a specific, I'd love to pray for you. And she was like, wow, like, I think she was really touched that I was praying for her, and that meant a lot to her. And she's like, no, I'm sure whatever you're praying is great. Like, thank you for doing that, you know? So then she came over a couple weeks later, and she said, hey, you know how you mentioned that you were praying for me? I actually have something that I'd love you to pray about. And just began to share, like, some stuff going on in her life. And so that just opened up, like, a series of conversations that we've been having together about where she's coming from and some of her struggles. And it's just been this wonderful thing. And it was just simply saying, hey, I'm praying. How can I specifically pray for you? And so I think that, you know, again, the evangelism, like, that word definitely, there's some unpleasant imagery that comes with that of handing out tracts or whatnot that doesn't appeal to me. But I think that offering just some, hey, I'm experiencing God through prayer, and how can I extend that to you, I think is a really refreshing thing for folks, at least we've found.
One thought to add was, again, to emphasize that people, we make up the church, not this building, and people are no longer just coming saying, oh, I really think I need to go to church this Sunday to hear something from God or to experience God. Most people say that they experience that outside of the church. And so extending the church, going out to people, relationships, and again, I think that happens really in these partnerships that we create with community organizations, that as you're doing the work, you're getting to have conversations. And so if you want this space to be more vibrant, I think we have to focus not on how do we get people here, but how do we be missional? How do we meet the needs in our community in a way that is not, I think, deceptive, again, about getting them to come here, but because we truly care about people and that we truly care about the needs here in our community. And so I think, again, I would just emphasize partnerships and getting out of here and making church growth not your priority if you want to grow the church.
Hi, everybody. My name's Mike. I'm from Sheboygan. And I first heard that Brian was going to be here a couple weeks ago and got excited because I thought, well, that's an indication there's going to be a community here that's interested in this kind of thinking. I work as a chiropractor, but most of my work now is in the special needs community. I have a special needs daughter who's quadriplegic. So I'm very interested in the ways that our communities are responding to people that are on the outside. And so I'm going to just make kind of a statement and then ask for responses that's not that specific about the special needs community. I've been very influenced by a thinker named René Girard over the past 30 years. And Dr. Girard said something that was really relevant to my understanding of Jesus. And he said that Jesus really meant something when he said, I'm taking away the sin of the world. And I think that that when we honestly look at that kind of a claim, we need to be looking very deeply into who and what we are. And we're getting wonderful information now from the scientific community that validates that Jesus, in fact, was talking about something that we can understand. And that something is what's called the separation challenge and the attachment solution. And almost every story that's in the Gospels is about some form of someone who's separated from the community and is then brought back in. Certainly the children that you work with autism and kids with severe disabilities are excluded from many different, from all of our institutions. In fact, my church took 15 years to get a ramp built so that my daughter could get in. I'm Catholic. And of course, our church is old and exempt from disability laws. To get back on my point, I apologize for rambling. Knowing that we have in our deepest biological selves a desire to attach, and that if we're willing to acknowledge our humanity, that we need to be able to say that attachment is one of at least, if not our primary survival strategy. We need, for a period of up to 12 years, almost complete attention from some adults who can steer us. And so when we have that separation anxiety from birth, or when a child with a disability doesn't find nurturing in the community or the parents start to lose that, we end up with a whole lot of anxiety going on. And I think as a culture, that's part of what's happening now, is that and I'm 55 now, and my daughter's 22. Both my daughters are 22 and 22 and a half. Our older was adopted. And they're in a position where the eldering that what could have been expected for most of human history isn't possible to deliver, because the world that they're living in is faster than me. I don't know how to do the things on a computer or to relate to folks in her age group with the speed that she does. And so when she asks me questions, and we've talked about this, about what's she going to be doing in her life, my answers aren't competent to meet her need. And so in terms of maintaining an attachment and reducing her anxiety about what to do in her life, that becomes a really difficult situation. And so to bring it back to Girard and to Jesus, we have real science now that shows us how to repair these attachment breaks and the separation anxieties. And all of us can look at this because we can see as we look around that almost all of us look alike. And we've got attachment breaks in our communities that we can now understand from a biological point of view. And I think I just want to leave it with that as a statement and ask you to respond.
All of us are just feeling connected to you in sharing that, and I think we could feel your emotion in that. And I think, as a person with a lot of autism in my family, I especially have a feeling of connection. As you were talking, I just kept thinking about that word religion that has fallen on such hard times now, that one account of the etymology or the origin of the word is that it means re again, and lig is ligament. Fits for a chiropractor too. Religion is about re-ligamenting what has been dislocated and separated. And I think about the Apostle Paul's phrase that he calls his whole thing the ministry of reconciliation, re-ligamenting, reconnecting, reattaching what's been excluded and scapegoated and shamed and pushed away. So this is so much of our work. And here's the irony: at this time when the church in some ways is very concerned about its future and its numbers and all the rest, has there ever been a time when we have a greater need to help us rediscover our connectedness? And so here is our great good news to say we're all connected. You may have forgotten that you're connected. We're here to remind you that we're all connected. And that is really good news, because it means we're not alone. It means we're not isolated. It means we're not really disconnected, that we really are connected. And we're connected in God's love. We're connected in this creation. And boy, that's good news. And I'm thinking about what we're going to be talking about this afternoon. That's something to sing about. That's something to celebrate. That's something to create art about. And boy, you imagine a group of people who just want to get together at least once a week to celebrate our connectedness. That's kind of a cool thing to be part of.
I wanted to echo the sense of appreciation for your vulnerability. And the other thing I wanted to pick up on was you referenced the biology a number of times. And one of the growing edges and awareness is, for me, theologically, that is very fascinating, is coming to understand more deeply how every part of creation goes through all of this that we're talking about today. And that, you know, our conversation has been primarily human-centered, and that's real and that's important. But it is happening at all levels and always has been, and there's so much possibility for synergy as we, thinking about thresholds, maybe some of us have a threshold into understanding that comes through biology or through physics, or through paying attention to certain species of animals or outer space. And I just sort of wonder what can emerge if we really pay attention, not that this is, you know, God created it and then it's working on its own and, you know, la-di-da, but that there are intricate communication connection systems in every level of creation that have so much to teach us about how we operate, how we think, and what it means for any theological idea, death, resurrection, community, anything. And for me, I just feel like the future is wide open for how to explore and celebrate that in all kinds of ways, in worship and other things.
As I was listening to you, I just thought, gosh, I'd love to learn more from your perspective of what are some things that we can do to serve other families like yourself. So even I'd love to talk to you afterwards and hear more. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. I'm the daughter of an evolutionary geneticist. So the conversation in my house growing up, the dinner table lecture every night, really, it is really the foundation of my spirituality, is the interconnectedness of life. And While I was writing my thesis in seminary, I was thinking about, you know, the chain of creation, you know, this idea that humans are at the top of the chain, you know, and closest to God. And someone said, you know, we're trying to become gods. We do emphasize perfection, you know, we're always striving for that as though we're really at the top of the chain. But science, you know, it's scientific discovery just reminds us all the time to get over that. And to realize, you know, who we really are. So I have a 14-year-old son, and, you know, as a 14-year-old boy, white boy in America, he can be a little cocky. And he's trained to be. And so one way that I try and get him to, you know, come down off of that a little bit is to remind him, you think you're like this individual, you know, living being. But the fact is, you would be dead without bacteria. Right? You depend on these small organisms. And in fact, we all depend on the simplest forms of life allow us to live. So kind of, I think sometimes fear and our desire to be close to God makes us live in that land of excluding that, which makes us afraid, perhaps represents our own frailty and vulnerability. And when you were talking, I was thinking of a man sitting by a pool of water that he thought was healing for like 30 years, and no one came. Where was everybody? That's always the story. That's always the thought in my mind. Where was everybody for 30 years while this poor man was sitting there trying to get into that pool for healing? We need to not be those people who don't show up.
One just brief thought to close that out is, as I'm getting ready to go to seminary, one of the things I'm excited about is the different contextual theologies, and one of those being disability theology. And I think sometimes we think with this idea that, you know, by inviting someone into our community, we offer them wholeness. And I think the reality is we need each other, and we become more whole through each other and through that relationship, and realizing that it's not us saving these people or making them whole, but that by coming together in relationship, we all become more whole. We all become more fully human and represent that image of God that we were created in. And I think that in many ways we're trying to recover and rediscover. And so it goes, I think, that both ways, not just looking at people who are marginalized or people outside of our communities and thinking that we offer them solutions and salvation, but that together we discover God more fully.
All right, so we're going to do one last thing together before we break for lunch. I'm going to ask a question for everybody. Just two sentences or so. We'll start with the panel and then work out. And that question is simply, what do you want to take away from what you've heard so far? Or what question are you wrestling with? Just in a sentence or two, because then we're going to do something afterwards. So you have to tell everyone what thought are you going to carry out of this to lunch with you. If there's anyone on the panel that wants to jump in there.
He didn't pay me to say this, but Jason's totally cool for organizing this thing today. So that's one thing. Just that the constant in life is change and stay open.
Mine is a question, and that I find myself asking myself a lot. But do you have the freedom of imagination to see and envision something new, something different? Not completely different from what is or has been, but a different direction that's tied to its past. And so do I have a radical freedom of imagination for that?
Where do innovation and institutionalism meet, and how do you build bridges for that?
Do we have the courage that is also part of our Christian tradition? This tremendous courage to go out in the world and
make that, you know, what we imagine, can we bring it into life?
Like, these folks are going to be down to earth, like, how do I preach my next sermon or whatever it might be? What's on your mind right now?
I have a kind of simple question, I think. It's just, should the church survive? Why should it survive?
Mine's more of a reaffirmation, quite a bit that I've already learned in seminary, but, you know, the reaffirmation of context, presence, and relationship. So I think that's...
I just was wondering, thinking about the old song I sang when I was a kid, "They'll Know We Are Christians by Our Love," and I'm wondering, will they?
You're here. Anyone else? Thoughts that you're going to go with?
I was reminded that in an era of change, I need to pay attention to tending grief before nurturing hope.
As a young person, I often feel like the culture of the church and the culture that I spend a lot of my life outside of the church in is very different and very separate. And so I think I struggle a lot with how do I help, as someone working in the church, help the church understand that this culture that's completely outside and that for me as a young person, I feel like I often don't relate to and I'm in the system. And so how do we help people who are not within our churches connect to that?
Just a simple idea that there is hope.
As we rethink the church, how do we think about our history in meaningful ways that are relevant for us today without navel-gazing too much and grieving too much and not moving forward?
Is the church really a place, or are we always going out into the church itself?
That part of this is thinking through a complete reorientation of what it means to be faithful.